You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 25th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Midori House is brought to you in association with Thailand. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Andrew Muller. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, as Muslim Brotherhood candidate Mohamed Morsi is finally declared the winner of Egypt's chaotic presidential election, we'll have the latest reaction from Cairo.
It relieves the country from being in a military rule for over a year and a half now. After this announcement, the whole country feels relief that the power is now in a civil hands.
As Men's Fashion Week continues in Milan, we'll discuss the latest in, appropriately enough, men's fashion. We'll be in St. Petersburg for Vladimir Putin's return to the International Economic Forum. It's probably safe to assume that he didn't start his speech with a joke. And Fidel Castro discovers the joys of brevity. But as we'll learn, it hasn't necessarily made him any more comprehensible.
On a good day, when I was in a good mood, you feel you're witnessing history and absolutely fascinating to hear someone like him close up. On a bad day, it was pretty mind-numbing, to be frank.
All that, plus music as well, coming up in the next hour here on Midori House. But before all that, these are the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Monocle 24 News. At least 19 people have died today in South Africa after a passenger bus they were travelling in overturned on a motorway near Meyerton, south of Johannesburg, and went off a bridge. Police Captain Shada Mashabane said the driver may have lost control of the vehicle, which hit the rails of the bridge, then plummeted 33 feet to the ground.
Police found that the bus lost control and it drove over safety rails. We've got 56 injuries, 19 died. Of this 19, 13 is the females, 6 is males.
The International Committee of the Red Cross President Jacob Kellenberger has said today that the ICRC has made renewed efforts to enter the Syrian town of Homs to evacuate trapped civilians and casualties, but it has yet to get agreement from both sides.
We have now made a second demarche, in fact, today to go back to enter into the relevant places in Homs together with the Syrian Red Crescent. In order to go to a place in a situation like it is now, it is important to have an unambiguous agreement of those concerned in the violence, of all, I underline, of all.
Egypt's first democratically elected President Mohamed Morsi has called for national unity after being declared the winner of last weekend's election runoff. The UK's Foreign Secretary, William Hague, said the new president must abide by his commitment to include those who didn't actually vote for him.
It is very important in the eyes of the friends of Egypt here in Europe and the friends of Egypt in the United Kingdom that this is an inclusive and transparent democratic process in Egypt, that the president lives up to what he has said about being inclusive, particularly in upholding the rights of women and in upholding the rights of religious minorities.
A huge archive of letters, papers, photographs and artefacts that shed new light on Indian leader Mahatma Gandhi and his time in South Africa will be auctioned here in London next month and is expected to fetch over £500,000. Dr. Gabrielle Heaton, who is a books and manuscript specialist at Sotheby's, explained why it was so important.
This is a tremendous and very rich collection that contains material that belonged to Gandhi's very close friend, Herman Kallenbach. It includes letters by Gandhi to Kallenbach and also many letters from Gandhi's sons and also his cousins to Kallenbach. Very intimate personal letters covering many decades, actually.
England's football captain Steven Gerrard has said today that he was committed to leading his side towards the 2014 World Cup, despite being devastated by England's loss against Italy in the Euro 2012 quarterfinals last night.
I'm available as long as I'm wanted at this level. And the manager told me he wants me to continue and carry on. And at times, you know, the football hasn't been fantastic. We haven't blown people away. But, you know, we've stuck together. We've fought hard. We've given every inch of effort we can give. You know, at times it's been difficult, you know, without the ball. And the possession stats speak for themselves. It tells you that, you know, moving forward as a nation, we do need to try and improve with the ball.
And finally, Lonesome George, the last remaining giant tortoise of his kind and a conservation icon, has died of unknown causes, the Galapagos National Park has said. He was thought to be about 100 years old. He was found in 1972, and had become a symbol of Ecuador's Galapagos Islands, which attracted some 180,000 visitors last year. The giant Galapagos tortoise can live up to 200 years old, were among the species that helped Charles Darwin formulate his theory of evolution in the 19th century. And those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Jonathan. Unknown causes and 100 and how many years old?
Well, they say he's 100, but most tortoises live up to about 200.
Really?
Giant tortoises. Yeah, they can live up to...
He's been felled in his prime.
Yeah, I wonder what happened to poor old George. Maybe just being a bachelor was too much for him.
Clearly. Well, perhaps just being called Lonesome George depressed him.
Maybe.
It's not impossible. Thank you for that. It's 18:06 here in London. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
From London, this is Monocle 24.
London, New York, Hong Kong, and Tokyo. As a Monocle 24.
Welcome to Monocle 24.
Aus London, das ist Monocle 24.
Από το Λονδίνο, αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Λονδίνο, Μπρούσε, Monocle 24.
Lontosta käsin, tämä on Monocle 24.
Lontombo, as a Monocle 24.
Lontadan, burası Monocle 24.
Londonist, sinä Monocle 24.
De Londres, essa é a Monocle 24.
O que quini natteiro no a Monocle 24.
Αυτό είναι το Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Du lyssnar på Monocle 24.
Kuuntelet Monocle 24.
Viestes Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 taget, ja.
As you've just been reminded, in a multiplicity of languages, you're listening to Monocle 24. This is Midori House, live from Studio One in London. Now, as if Egypt hadn't waited long enough for its first democratically elected leader. After a series of delays, the country's presidential election commission announced the winner of Egypt's first meaningful election in 5,000 years or so yesterday. Mohamed Morsi, the Muslim Brotherhood candidate, was declared a narrow victor over Ahmed Shafik, former prime minister under deposed dictator Hosni Mubarak. Undeniably exciting, though Egypt's embrace of democracy is, it is fair to say that a runoff between a bearded theocrat and a henchman of the overthrown tyranny was not the preferred outcome of the protesters who first thronged Tahrir Square last January. It's also uncertain how much power the new president will really be able to wield. The military council, which has ruled since Mubarak was ousted, has awarded significant powers to itself. Our reporter Rebecca Collard has been asking Cairo what they make of it.
Mohamed Morsi will be the next president of Egypt. The results were announced by Egypt's Presidential Elections Commission on Sunday. Morsi won with 52% of the vote over Ahmed Shafik, an Air Force commander and prime minister under ousted President Hosni Mubarak. Thousands of Egyptians returned to Tahrir Square, but this time to celebrate a victory. The Muslim Brotherhood, which spent 80 years as an opposition movement and was outlawed under the Mubarak regime, has now won Egypt's presidency. Morsi's supporters flood into Tahrir Square, waving Egyptian flags and hoisting pictures of their soon-to-be president. Most in Tahrir Square voted for Morsi, but many here are celebrating the first time they elected their own head of state.
I'm very happy. People are celebrating that democracy has finally come to Egypt.
Amr Musa.
It relieves the country from being in a military rule for over a year and a half now. After this announcement, the whole country feels relief that the power is now in a civil hands. The transition period is over now. We can start working together, hopefully, on building this new country.
But while some celebrated, others chanted against GAF, the military council which has controlled Egypt since the fall of Mubarak. 2 weeks ago, SCAF dissolved Egypt's recently elected parliament. And as the ballots were counted in this presidential race, SCAF issued a series of decrees essentially stripping the new president of much of his authority and affording itself new powers. In Tahrir Square, many say they will continue to protest until these military decrees are reversed.
This is not just a celebration, this is a protest. Our protest will continue until the decrees are declared void and the president has all his authority and the law which allows military police to arbitrarily arrest us is reversed. Until these demands are complied with, we are staying in Tahrir Square.
But not all Egyptians are celebrating the Muslim Brotherhood victory. Some worry about rule under the Islamist party. In a rooftop bar on the other side of downtown, Zakaria Al-Hadi says he doesn't want religion in his government.
I'm actually against the theocracy type of regime. There's no transparency about the structure of this group. You don't know what they do. They have a history, a bloody history, of being against liberalism in a society.
Omar Bakri is also concerned about the Muslim Brotherhood's new power.
The streets will have a more Islamic attitude. They will spread their, you know, ideology, and they will be more at ease. The fear is them abusing God to control these people and lead them the way they want, without these people being aware that they're being led in the wrong direction.
Many of the revolutionaries who led last year's uprising saw the Muslim Brotherhood as too compromising with the army. And Omar says he believes the Brotherhood struck a deal with SCAF.
There was a sort of a battle coming, and the Islamists were preparing weapons and these guys were preparing their army. But I think they both realized that the destruction would be too strong. And so, you know, they cut a deal. I just hope it doesn't use the same methods of the old regime. So we'll just have to wait and see.
SCAF has promised to hand back full control to a civilian government on June 30th. While many here remain skeptical about this transfer of power, for now, they are celebrating the simple fact that their votes have been counted. For Monocle in Cairo, I'm Rebecca Collins.
And Rebecca joins me now live from Cairo. Good evening, Rebecca.
Hi, good evening, Andrew.
One day after the result was declared, what have you seen and heard in Cairo today?
Well, I mean, last night you had kind of an immediate taking to Tahrir Square, thousands of people, and I mean, a very different sort of atmosphere than we've seen in recent weeks, celebrations, fireworks, and today those crowds are smaller, but there's still an atmosphere of celebration.
Okay, well, I mean, it's always interesting to see a country getting used to the idea of democracy, and I think a key indicator of the potential health of any democracy is how the losers of a first election react. Are Shafiq's people and Shafiq's supporters generally behaving themselves?
As of yet, yes. I mean, yesterday when we just after the results, I spoke to a lot of people on the street who voted for Shafiq, and I was, to be honest, surprised that many of them said, you know, okay, Morsi was elected, and now we'll just kind of wait and see what he does, and seemed relatively accepting of that. Definitely, I know that there was kind of areas of town where there are kind of concentrations of Shafiq supporters, which weren't quite as happy about the situation. But as of yet, we haven't seen any sort of a backlash. But I mean, maybe that will change when policies start to change. But as of yet, no, nothing like that.
Is there, if not, I guess, any dissent with the election result? Any nervousness, especially among? And I'm asking this because one of your interviewees used the lovely phrase abusing God to describe his fears of what a Muslim Brotherhood government president might do. Whether there's any nerves among secular or moderate or Christian Egyptians?
Absolutely. I mean, since before even the result, there has been, I mean, of course, a hesitation for liberal, secular, or Christian Egyptians of a kind of Islamization of Egypt, and that's a fear for a lot of people, like on a social level, that their rights will be taken away, and there's definitely an atmosphere of that, and also kind of this other idea that I think somebody in my clip spoke about, that the feeling like the air organization isn't just Islamic, but also not transparent. So specifically for, I think, kind of the young revolutionaries who took to Tahrir in January of 2011, this wasn't the revolutionary candidate. This wasn't the person that they felt represented their interests. And you know, yesterday, just after the results were announced, I was on the street talking to one Egyptian man. He was maybe in his 40s, and he was saying, "This is excellent. Morsi has won, and he's our revolutionary candidate." And two young guys, maybe in their early 20s, interrupted him and said, "No, no, he's not the revolutionary candidate. He's not the one that represents us." So I think you kind of have two different types of nervousness. One about, yeah, kind of social reforms. And also about the fact that this candidate from the Muslim Brotherhood might not represent these revolutionaries who kind of pushed for this uprising and the overthrow of Mubarak.
Well, you mentioned a concern there about a lack of transparency, and you also mentioned that the SCAF have said that they will transfer power to the civilian authorities on June 30th. But has anybody yet figured out, and I guess Mohamed Morsi chief among them, how much he will actually be able to do?
That is a very difficult question at this point. You know, the Muslim Brotherhood is very organized. They have been an opposition group for 80 years. So they definitely have ideas and policies and things they want to do. But at the same time, you know, in the last 2 weeks, we have seen first the Egyptian parliament, which was recently elected and very much controlled by the Muslim Brotherhood party, the Freedom and Justice Party, dissolved. And then, I mean, basically, as they were counting the votes, SCAF, the Supreme Council of the Armed Forces, who is the military council that has controlled the country since Mubarak stepped down, issued a number of decrees which essentially eroded most of the president's powers and gave themselves all kinds of new powers and new authority. And when you look at this situation now, you kind of wonder, okay, great, Egypt has a democratically elected president, but it's hard to tell right now what that president is going to be able to do for Egyptians.
Rebecca Collard, Monocle contributor in Cairo, thank you very much for joining me this evening. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One in London. We'll be right back after this.
Modern Thailand is on the move. Take transport. We're building urban mass transit systems and a $15.4 billion high-speed rail link that will crisscross the country faster than ever before. We've even developed a solar-powered prototype of our famous tuk-tuks for a greener urban journey. And if you think that sounds good, wait until you hear our homegrown teapot. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
The Antwerp Academy of Fashion has a reputation for turning out some of the most cutting-edge designers of the day. It's where rising stars are discovered and a heady place to witness the impulses of Generation Next. We travel to Antwerp to scout out students on the threshold of success.
Fashion for me, first of all, it's a research. It's a research about the human, it's research about who they are, how they think. I start really looking up for images of sleeping beautiful woman, Surprisingly, I found it in horror movies. So all the pieces are made with a red thread only. If you come closer, you will see that the blood really runs in the garment.
You can watch this film and many more from affairs to business, culture to design in our program archive on monocle.com.
You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Now, it's presently Men's Fashion Week in Milan, which seems an excellent moment to reflect upon the present state of men's fashion. And joining me now to do exactly that, fresh off the plane from Milan, is Monocle's editor-in-chief, Tyler Boulle. Good evening.
Good evening.
We've spoken a bit about Italian fashion and how it is reacting or responding to or running in terror from Italy's present straitened circumstances. Was there much of that in the air in Milan this week?
We hosted an event last night, and we had a number of brand owners, a number of designers, and we also had a number of retailers there as well. And it was very interesting listening to the big brands first, because they said turnout was much lower. So, you know, over the course of last week, we would have been hearing from our Jonathan Openshaw, who was down at Pitti Uomo, which is, of course, is the other big men's fashion fair, the much more tradey fair, which is down in Florence. So attendance numbers down on the part of Italians. And I think a lot of people say, well, okay, so if the Italians aren't buying, it's not such a big deal. But, in fact, Italy incorporated just as a market, and you have to think of all of the Italian cities and second and third tier cities, you know, they all have a number of multi-brand retailers who are big spenders. So, you know, Italy in its own right, you know, is, you know, if you look at champagne consumption, if you look at watch sales, it's an incredibly important market globally. So, massive fear that there's no turnout. Businesses are going under, businesses that have been around for generations. And those that are around, if they buy, when are they going to pay the bills?
I mean, there's also been this trend of Italian brands being bought by French conglomerates. Are they kind of hovering vulture-like, picking them up on the cheap, or is this something that would have happened anyway?
I think that would have happened anyway, and of course, and it's not just the French. You see a number of Chinese, a lot of Koreans are also there as well. You know, looking at what they can snap up at the moment, because you've also seen a lot of these Italian brands also buying back their licenses, and of course a lot of these, particularly, out of Hong Kong and China, there's a number of holding companies that would love nothing more than to get their hand on an old family business and then probably license the hell out of it.
But does that end up compromising the brand in any way? I mean, how important to Italian fashion brands is the perception that they are Italian fashion brands?
I think from the whole provenance perspective, if you're at the top end of the market, it's still incredibly important. And a lot of companies, will say that, oh yes, we have a factory maybe in Romania and it's fine because it's all completely Italian run and it's Italian technology and it's Italian sewing machines. But I think at the end of the day, there's still a disconnect if a brand is pushing itself as being Italian and it has made in Bulgaria or it has made in Sri Lanka in it.
And what of the actual designs you saw in Milan? Is there any sense at all that the designers are probably being inspired by the current circumstances, is the wrong word, but reacting to them in any way?
I think they are. What we saw probably over the last 3 or 4 years were a number of companies really trying to appeal to the Asian consumer, the Chinese consumer, in a rather blatant way. I'm going to go and make you a blazer, and look at, I'm going to put a dragon on the back of it, we're going to have a lot of red and gold, and it's true. I mean, you saw a lot of that. You saw it in the watch business as well. I think now, and as you were saying in the intro, you're definitely seeing a return to a conservatism, because I think a lot of companies realize that when the buyers come through the front doors, they don't want to have any risk. They don't want to be left with any crazy merchandise at the end of the season. So I think everyone saw that people were reining in, they were being a little bit more conservative. And oddly, there's, funnily enough, a magazine which was quite famous in the 1980s, during the whole Reagan era, the whole sort of, rise of sort of preppy culture. The people at Fairchild, owned by Condé Nast, they're bringing back M magazine, just the letter M, this autumn. So it sort of might really sort of reflect that we're moving into very sort of post-conservative times.
Well, that given, was there anything you saw in the collection collections that particularly impressed you?
I didn't see a lot of shows because I came straight from holiday hosting a party and left. But when I spoke to our correspondents, they did say that things are just much more wearable. And wearable means that, on the side of some companies, which of course have, probably rather fearsome boards, but also are, have a number of shareholders and they're publicly traded on the Milan or Paris exchange, they're definitely playing it safe. And if you're a small family business as well, you're not going to try to risk it too much at the moment.
Are you more excited by what's happening in fashion in Asia?
I think retail-wise, definitely, and what we saw when we spoke to people as well, they said America's bouncing back, but it is the market. It's Korea. Despite what everyone says about Japan, they said the Japanese were buying like crazy, and that means as well that also if you've got a really good retailer and they know how to buy and they know how to assemble a look, then you can get a very different interpretation of what's on offer. With an Italian fashion brand, you might see it presented one way in London or Paris, but it will look radically different and maybe even superior when you see it in Kobe.
But how have China and Korea and Japan remained solid as Europe sort of teeters from one crisis to the next?
Well, I think that one curious discussion, because this is the summer buying season, so everyone's buying for, of course, summer 2013. When I was asking, why is Japan holding up so well? Well, they said, one reason is that there's been a real sort of boom in summer style, and this has sort of happened over the last 3 or 4 years. It's not just post tsunami and post earthquake electricity cuts, but there has been a real impact because Japan's gone for this whole business cool. So it's meant that you could probably get away with sort of a decent weight wool suit all year round in Tokyo, and you'd be a little bit sweaty on the underground. That won't work now because they're keeping offices at around 28 or 29 degrees, and that actually spells great news if you're a retailer, because men do have to come in and buy unlined suits and they have to buy special undershirts.
To return to Italy there, I guess, because that is where you've just been, in terms of not just in fashion but for, I guess, what you might think of as brand Italy as a whole, do you think it will endure despite or beyond the current crisis? Because I remember doing a story about Ireland for Monocle a couple of years ago, and a few people actually said our image is the kind of thing that can sustain a few knocks. It actually makes us seem sort of rugged and hard wearing and enduring in a way that it wouldn't for Germany. Does Italy have that going for it, or am I trying a bit hard here?
Well, we didn't get right to the point during the break, but we were talking about Naples, and so I was down in Naples and south on the Amalfi Coast, and it's a complete bubble. There's no sense that there's any problem. There are as many yachts out there as you've ever seen. You could even book a boat if you wanted to. All of the hotels were full, and it was incredible. You even take the new Frecciarossa, which is Trenitalia's new, super high-speed rail link all the way up to Milan, and it runs like a Swiss train. And so you sort of think, where's the problem in Italy? And you also go through a complete, a brand new train station in Naples as well. So I do think that yes, you might see some, generational family businesses go under. They probably would have gone under anyway. But I think that come August, I think the Italians will be fine again.
Tyler Brulé, Monocle's editor-in-chief, thank you very much for joining us. To take us to the news halfway through the hour, keeping it Italian, this is Alessandra Amoroso with Ciao.
Ti ho detto delle cose che non avrei voluto dire.
It was Alessandra Amoroso with Ciao. It's 31 minutes past 1800 hours here in London, and these are the news headlines with Jonathan Wheatley.
Thanks very much. At least 19 people have died today in South Africa after a passenger bus they were travelling in overturned on a motorway near Meyerton, south of Johannesburg, and went off the bridge. It's believed the driver lost control of the vehicle, which hit the rails of the bridge, then plummeted 33 feet to the ground. The International Committee of the Red Cross President, Jakob Kellenberger, has said today that the ICRC has made renewed efforts to enter the Syrian town of Homs to evacuate trapped civilians and casualties, but is yet to get agreement from both sides. Egypt's first democratically elected president, Mohamed Morsi, has called for national unity after being declared the winner of last weekend's election runoff. A huge archive of letters, papers, photographs and artefacts that shed new light on the Indian leader Mahatma Gandhi and his time in South Africa will be auctioned here in London next month and is expected to fetch over £500,000. And some sports news now. England's football captain Steven Gerrard has said today that he's committed to leading his side towards the 2014 World Cup, despite being devastated by England's loss against Italy in the Euro 2012 quarterfinals last night. And those are the stories here on Monocle 24.
Welcome back to Midori House. Now, every day on this programme, we summon one of Monocle's editors from the floor upstairs to talk us through what's in their section of the current issue and or where they've been and or what they've got coming up. It's Monday, which means current affairs, and that means senior editor Sophie Grove joins me now in Studio One.
Hello.
Good evening.
Thank you for summoning me.
I didn't really, did I? I just looked up and you were there.
And here I was. Yes, I've just got back from Beirut and Lebanon. And then I actually kind of, I was going to come back to London and I went straight to Italy in a sort of round the Med tour. But I'm here to talk about Beirut mainly.
Which I'm pleased to hear because it is, as you know, one of my very favourite places in the world. Though I haven't been, I was last there for Monocle 3 or 4 years ago, I think. How is it? How is the old place doing?
Well, it's quite fun. It's amazingly intense and hedonistic and all those things and cosmopolitan, chaotic as ever. There's huge power shortages there, which everyone's moaning about massively. I think it's because during the Civil War, everyone just plugged into the mains. There's this kind of cat's cradle in the street, which looks very charming, but it actually means that people are just not paying for their electricity. So it's gone a bit wrong in that sense. And obviously, there are some real tensions there because of the crisis in Syria. And we were looking at two places mostly. I went to Baalbek, which is an amazing town and an archaeological site just in the north and only an hour from Damascus and quite near the border. And it's quite tense. It's a Hezbollah stronghold in the Bekaa Valley. And we did a piece about the international festival there and how incredible these organisers are, really. They keep going through conflicts and wars and kidnap scandals, well, crises of so many different magnitudes, and that you can't believe that they're going to pull off some incredible cultural soiree, which they then do. But we're really looking at that and also the situation there, how Hezbollah are reacting to the situation in Syria.
Well, they are an interesting player in this, and they've been remarkably quiet. And they're the dog that has not yet barked, as I've spent a bit of time with them myself at various points in Lebanon. And obviously they have a financial but, I think, well, it's a fairly loveless marriage, I think, between Hezbollah and the Baathists in Syria.
Exactly. I mean, it looks like, really, that Assad and the Syrian regime have been just a conduit for money and arms from Iran. And the Pentagon estimates that there's $200 million a year in funding and aid to Hezbollah from Tehran. So they really need Assad on side. And when you're in Baalbek, that more or less every cafe, the amazing meat pie shops they have there and the nargile shops, they all have a picture of him alongside a picture of their leader Nasrallah and a picture of some of the Ayatollah Khamenei and other candidates. And
I was going to ask you if Hezbollah's billboard campaign was continuing apace, because when I was last in Beirut, which I think was on assignment for Monocle not long after the Hezbollah-Israel war of a few years ago, the whole road into Beirut from the airport was just one Hezbollah billboard after another, and everywhere as we drove through the Bekaa Valley, just huge portraits of destroyed Israeli materiel and big triumphal portraits of Hassan Nasrallah.
Yeah, there's lots of waving Nasrallah. So these, this kind of cardboard cutout silhouette, kind of this cheering thing, saying, "Welcome to the Bekaa Valley." You think, "Oh, thank you. How kind." I met the mayor of Baalbek, who isn't a member of Hezbollah, but he says he's politically cheering them on, as it were, and a couple of Hezbollah. We talked about the situation in Syria and mainly the festival. I mean, they have a bit of a sort of lockdown on journalistic sort of contact, and even though they do have a press office, strangely, but it's unusual that they talk really straight about politics. But, I mean, we do know that Nasrallah came out in May and talked about you know, the violence in Syria, called for an end to it, which was seen as one of the first steps towards condemning it. And then the other flashpoint in Lebanon is Tripoli, which is the second city, really. It's a very poor city, a port city on right up on the coast, right next to the Syrian border. And there we're seeing, you know, these sporadic clashes between the Alawite community and the Sunni community, where a Salafist movement has gathered. They're blasting each other with rocket-propelled grenades and shelling each other from time to time. And in between that, you know, we're seeing the different political factions, the Alawites, the Sunnis, the Shiites, all coming and having to have an opinion and a moral position on what's happening in Syria. So it's really influencing the politics in Lebanon.
And how nervous are people? Because obviously people in Lebanon must hold their breath every time there's a report of sectarian clashes. And the ones you mentioned in Tripoli have been extremely serious. Because the last time, of course, this kicked off in the mid-70s, that was the next 18 years wiped out. Are people worried that it may become uncontainable in Lebanon?
I think they're certainly worried. And they talk about how they're, you know, they're the victim of their neighbours. You know, these are proxy sort of wars, really, that are sort of on their turf. And it's all about, you know, the influence of these kind of, you know, Middle Eastern superpowers and what they want to do with Lebanon. And they can stir up trouble there very, very quickly. So they feel that they're a victim of that. And they keep on saying, no, we love life. We love, you know, we forget so easily. They're so optimistic, but they really do know that they're on very thin ice at the moment in terms of all of the different situations. And you can see the Druze and the Christians are also, you know, very, very anxious to see exactly how this plays out and whether or not Hezbollah particularly can sustain popularity whilst still sort of championing Assad is really going to be interesting to see.
I think it's depressingly certain that it won't be the last time we end up talking at length about Lebanon on Monocle 24 in the next few months. But for the moment, Monocle Senior Editor Sophie Grove, thank you very much for joining me. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be right back after this.
At one of the world's busiest seaports, Laem Chabang, it's easy to see why Thailand is such a dynamic trading hub. With our entrepreneurial, multi-skilled workforce, we're busy making sure vital goods get to market on time, every time. It's this hands-on approach that's made us the globe's fifth largest container shipping nation. But it's not only goods we're exporting. Our pop music is a big hit too. To find out more, visit modern-thailand.com.
What does Mexico make you think of? Drugs, kidnappings, tequila and more drugs? Or how about a thriving economy, innovative business leaders, world-beating art, and the best in hospitality, and a rather good quality of life? As Mexicans prepare to elect a new president on July the 1st, this week on Monocle 24, we'll be going beyond the headlines and the stereotypes. We'll reveal a nation that international brands are desperate to crack, and where politics is vibrant and vital. We'll also reveal why you should put down that tequila as we investigate the Mezcal revival. Join us for Monocle's week-long Mexican survey on The Globalist and The Daily. Mexico 2012, this week on Monocle 24.
Now, since its inception in 1997, the St. Petersburg International Economic Forum has become, despite the unappetizing acronym SPIEF, something of a Davos for emerging markets, with an inevitable emphasis on Russia, oil and IT. This year's SPIEF, and it doesn't get better with repetition, saw the return of Vladimir Putin as host, having recently retrieved Russia's presidency from his mini-me, Dmitry Medvedev. However, the continuation of the now 12-year-long Putin era has not been universally welcomed. Increasing numbers of Russians have been willing to complain out loud about Russia's poverty, corruption, and apparent reluctance to improve, not something likely to encourage the foreign investment that the creaking country desperately needs. Peter van Dijk sent this report.
Хочу поблагодарить и представить тех, кто сегодня согласился участвовать In panel discussion after seminar after roundtable, in Russian and in English, speaker after speaker extols Russia's virtues. Greg Becker, the CEO of the Silicon Valley Bank, is making his first visit.
Great internet companies can be started here, but I also think the country has an ability to start great, deep technological companies maybe no other place in the world could be like.
In line with Russia's drive to modernize its economy, high-tech business and IT startups are a constant theme. The government has launched initiatives to encourage entrepreneurs, but it still feels like all but a select few are on their own. And even the biggest Russia boosters do nod to the challenges of doing business here. James Turley, the CEO of Ernst & Young, is a bluntly spoken member of the Russian government's Foreign Investment Advisory Council.
One of the things when we talk about the number of permits needed and whatnot, it's both the cost, but no one up here has said it. It also, every time there's a permit needed in any part of the world, not just in Russia, it introduces the opportunity for corruption. And nothing discourages the entrepreneur more than that.
Corruption. It has always been the elephant in the room when it comes to doing business, large or small, in Russia. These days, though, everyone talks about it, including the president in his keynote speech in St. Petersburg.
Коррупция, к сожалению, и без всякого преувеличения, самая большая угроза нашему развитию.
Corruption, without exaggeration, today, unfortunately, is the biggest threat to our development. The risks here are much bigger than the oscillations in oil prices. The people and the businesses are tired of routine corruption, of kickbacks in government bodies and in state companies.
It is hardly the first time either. Addressing investors in February, Putin talked up the government's plans to fight corruption, but he said the public had to do more too. The protesters who have taken to the streets over the past half year might argue that they are trying, but that the authorities are ignoring them. But while investors would welcome greater transparency, be it political or economic, they like the stability of Russian politics too. After all, democracy isn't necessarily good for the economy. Kirill Dmitriev is the head of the government's Russian Direct Investment Fund.
Europe traditionally had very strong democratic institutions, but it didn't save it from all of the issues that it's facing right now.
Dmitriev has $10 billion to invest in Russia along with foreign partners. He warns that political reform is not a cure-all.
What we, for example, have seen in Ukraine really scared lots of people because the so-called democratic orange revolution happened, and as a result, corruption increased by the fact of four times, and there was no rule of law, and all sorts of democratic parties were fighting, and the Ukrainian economy lost as a result of that.
The experience in neighboring Ukraine means the Russian government has a fine line to tread between political freedoms spurring the economy and political uncertainty or paralysis holding it back. Dmitriev expects evolution, not revolution. Jim O'Neill of Goldman Sachs, who grouped the big emerging economies of Russia, China, India and Brazil together as the BRIC countries a decade ago, is encouraged.
The protests that have been happening are very interesting because they seem to come from the middle classes, which is not usually the case in many countries. And if I look at the way the government has responded so far, it's obviously trying to think carefully about what to learn from it. So, you know, it's early signs, but there are some reasons to believe that they may respond to what people are saying.
The political changes have already begun. Dmitriev points to an easing of rules on registering political parties and a return to elections for regional governors. But another new law dramatically increased penalties for illegal protest actions, so the signals are mixed. Many investors would like to see a bit more.
I don't think it's a necessary condition to have political reform, but it definitely helps.
Roland Nash is chief strategist at Verno Capital in Moscow. He says the public, even the opposition, could in fact be an ally for Putin.
The economic benefits of having a middle class which is able to monitor a lot of the problems that Russia has in corruption and rule of law and so on can be huge, and it will eventually, or actually quite quickly, help Russia get to the place where I think Putin wants to take it.
Russia is a big country, though, and it naturally leans toward big government and big business. And, says Dmitriev of the Russian Direct Investment Fund, big business is happy.
Most of the largest investors we talk to are actually much less concerned about political situation. They believe that Russia is a stable country with stable growth prospects, and had unemployment in Russia been 20% like it is in Spain, for example, had youth unemployment been 50% as it is in many European countries, has debt been much larger than it is, I think investors would be much more concerned. I think what investors see in Russia and benefit from is a stable political system where decisions can be taken quickly, and that is highly important at the time of the crisis, where paralysis of decision making is highly detrimental to economy, but ability to quickly make decisions and affect change is key.
It is a persuasive argument. Expect Russia to be wrestling with it for some time. For Monocle in St. Petersburg, I'm Peter Van Dyke.
And staying in Russia for the next few minutes, this is Nyusha with her song Vospominanni, which I've almost certainly pronounced incredibly badly. It's currently the most requested track on Russian radio. That was Nyusha with Vospominanni.
Det här är Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Добро пожаловать, Monocle 24.
Essa è Monocle 24.
Detta är Monocle 24.
Están escuchando Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 this.
This is Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Cuba's semi-retired dictator Fidel Castro has never been famous for his succinctness, in much the same way that Benedict XVI has never been known for his militant atheism. The bearded blowhard spent a goodly proportion of his 46 years in office making interminable speeches to his snoring people. However, possibly in recognition of the fact that he won't live forever, even if it might seem like he already has, Castro has recently embraced a rigorous regime of self-editing. El Presidente's more recent forays into Cuba's state media have been uncharacteristically brisk. His utterances on subjects including history, agriculture, and science have tended towards the terse, if not gnomic. A little earlier, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck spoke to Andrew Cawthorn, former Havana bureau chief for Reuters, and started by hearkening back to a few of the former Cuban leader's more lengthy orations.
It was pretty extraordinary coming on a daily basis. I was in Cuba in the late 1990s and early 2000s for Reuters, and every couple of days he would pop up and give a major speech, and they would often last 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 hours. I mean, add to that the time you spend kind of waiting for him to start the speech and going through security checks as a journalist, and you could often invest a good 12 hours or more covering a Fidel Castro speech and maybe come out at 4 or 5 in the morning. So they were pretty extraordinary affairs. There was a sense on a good day, when I was in a good mood, you feel you're witnessing history, and you know, absolutely fascinating to hear someone like him close up. On a bad day, maybe when you're tired and a bit of a bad mood, it was pretty mind-numbing, to be frank.
Now, the local papers, especially Grama, have always kind of published everything he's had to say. Even in those days, did they kind of run lengthy editorials about his speeches?
Not just editorial, they would run the entire speeches. And the speeches were extraordinary intellectual tour de forces, going from medieval history to coffee plantation methods to whatever the current affair issue of the day was. Absolutely extraordinary. Sometimes they were sharp and witty and funny in parts, and sometimes just rambling and, you know, very hard to follow. I used to actually take books with me And I got through quite a few novels while speeches while Fidel Castro was giving speeches. I got ticked off once by one of his officials, actually, for being openly seen reading a book in the middle of the speech. But the thing is, you develop like a sixth sense. You can be listening to him doing something else, but immediately you get so used to listening to his tone of voice. If there's anything particularly newsworthy or interesting, your ear immediately zooms in, and then you reconcentrate on what he's saying.
Now, lately, since 10th of June to be precise, he's taken to speaking in a much shorter form, in paragraphs never more than 65 words. And everyone's a bit kind of concerned whether he's kind of lost it, to be blunt, or whether he's actually found a kind of new way of speaking to his followers. One of them that's been quoted in the Miami Herald today says, I respect all religions, though I don't believe in them. And another one says, yogis can do things with the human body that escape our imagination. Do you think even back in the old days he was slightly cryptic in the way he spoke, or is this a kind of a new tone of voice for him?
Oh, no. I mean, he's always spoken about every subject under the sun. I mean, he is actually an incredibly widely read person, and he has a photographic memory, and he gets obsessive on small minor things and is a micromanager. So to talk about yoga, to talk about farming methods, then to talk about the fall of communism in the East, to range between those subjects is completely normal for him, and has been characteristic for him since the early days when he was a student, in fact. What's unusual here, and is, I guess, a little bit amusing or ironic for those of us who follow Cuba closely, is the format he's chosen. The famously verbose, the guy who's given perhaps the longest speeches in history and could never kind of contain himself and express things succinctly, is going for this short form. So, that is amusing. One wonders what's happening. Has he suddenly adapted to the Twitter world? I mean, over here in Venezuela, where I work at the moment, Hugo Chavez, who's followed the Fidel Castro example and given enormous speeches himself, he loves Twitter, absolutely loves Twitter now. So he's giving these very short statements too. So I'd be really intrigued to know, has he been advised to do this? Has he just discovered this? Has someone told him this is the way people do it these days? And I know all sorts of theories are being spun around why he's doing this.
And do you notice that there is a kind of a real way of speaking in Latin America, then, that these long speeches are actually in the past were quite traditional, and maybe that now, you know, even these leaders are beginning to realise that they need to adapt for the kind of the social media age?
Yes. I mean, Fidel Castro and Hugo Chavez are the great examples of the long-winded speech makers. Their lives are kind of one permanent speech to their people, and with both of them, as time has gone on, spoken more and written slightly less, it would seem. But they do both seem to have be adapting to the modern age as well. Certainly Hugo Chavez is, and this is the first evidence that perhaps Fidel Castro is too. And I think it's also been slightly ironic to see how in these very hard left countries, which are constantly railing against imperialism and capitalism, such as Cuba and Venezuela, we're seeing how perhaps Twitter and the use of other formats with an origin in the United States have become very popular.
That was Andrew Cawthorne, Reuters former man in Havana. You're listening to Midori House, or rather you've been listening to Midori House, because that's all we have time for today. Thanks to our producer Dawn Trump, our researcher Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager Toby Hammond. Up next after the news is this week's episode of The Culture Show with Robert Bound. He'll be asking an eclectic mix of artists performing at the Sonar Music Festival in Barcelona about their reading habits.
Because I'm flying and traveling, I'm always reading a lot of magazines, and my two top ones are The Economist and a funny magazine called Monocle.
The Culture Show will also be looking at the Cannes Lions Festival, and they'll be attending one of the world's smallest literary events, so stay tuned for that. Also stay tuned for The Daily in 3 hours' time. Hugo MacDonald and myself will be anchoring that tonight. Steve Bloomfield will be back here with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. He'll have an item about sharks, which I'm really upset that I didn't get to do. But thank you for listening. Goodbye.